What is 3D printed cartilage, and will we be using it to replace arthritic joints anytime soon? We will talk about new advancements in arthritis research and what we can do to prevent and treat what is considered the nation's biggest form of physical disability. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll talk first with a biomedical engineer about 3D printed cartilage, and then with a physician who specializes in treating patients with arthritis and sports-related injuries. And we will learn more about current research, treatment, and prevention of arthritis, specifically osteoarthritis. And we will welcome your questions and your stories, your experiences, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our first guest. Dr. Bill Murphy is co-director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center and Harvey D. Spangler Professor of Biomedical Engineering in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, to lift the veil, we saw an article recently. It was actually in a Pennsylvania newspaper, but it was about people who are suffering from osteoarthritis and the pain and disability that goes along with this condition, but it also focused on the new advancements in arthritis research, including 3D printed cartilage. What is 3D printed cartilage?
Well, osteoarthritis, as you mentioned, is a tremendous scale problem, and 27 million people in the U.S. suffer from the disease. And the ways in which it's been treated oftentimes try to rely on the ability of cartilage to regenerate and, you know, using drugs and other kinds of interventions to get cartilage to regenerate itself. But cartilage doesn't do so quite so well. And so 3D printed cartilage is a sort of concept in which cartilage cells are printed layer by layer into a three-dimensional cartilage tissue. And the printing process in some ways is analogous to an inkjet printer, a common sort of inkjet printer.
Yeah, I saw one of them making an ear, of all things.
Yes, yeah, there's been actually some nice demonstrations of the ability to form three-dimensional tissues. And it's remarkable the level of control one can exert because it's printed layer by layer.
Well, so what is the hope here with 3D printed cartilage when it comes to arthritis sufferers?
Well, I think it's an interesting thing. You mentioned the ear, and the ear is composed of a different sort of cartilage when compared to the articular cartilage in a joint. So ear cartilage, nose cartilage, those kinds of tissues are a little bit easier to print in the sense that they have structural properties that are maybe a bit simpler. Articular cartilage in a joint has organization that's very important to the function of the cartilage. The surface in the joint needs to be smooth and allow for smooth gliding. But on the other end of the cartilage, right adjacent to the bone, it has to calcify. So you can imagine that there's a very different cartilage properties as you go through the cartilage layer by layer. What 3D printing offers is the potential to be able to print cartilage that's different as you go through. So you could actually generate articular cartilage in a joint that has the kind of properties that are in native functional human cartilage.
Yeah, and why does it need to be calcified near the joint?
Well, in order to link the cartilage to the native bone tissue that's right underneath the cartilage.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what's, I mean, are you busy making making these 3D printed joints in your spare time?
Well, you know, we work on sort of different aspects of what's called tissue engineering. This is a field where combinations of cells and materials and biological factors like proteins are combined together to form tissues either outside the body or inside the body. And, you know, one of the challenges in the field on the 3D printing side and in other approaches is not just getting the cells sort of formed into a three-dimensional construct, but then also giving them the right kinds of instructions to form a functional tissue. Cartilage, I think, is a really good example. It's possible to 3D print cartilage, but that's just the starting point. Those printed cells have to be able to form a tissue that functions like cartilage. And we're really only at the early stages of understanding what kinds of signals those cells need to see, what kinds of instructions they need to be exposed to in order to form cartilage that works.
Yeah, it truly sounds miraculous. It sounds like science fiction almost.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And when you see, when you see these kinds of devices in action, the kinds of things they can print are almost unlimited. Really, the geometries are almost unlimited.
So how far out are we to having a joint created by a 3D printer?
Well, like I said, I think the big challenge is trying to determine what are the instructions that need to happen after the printing. There are companies now that have been established that are printing stem cells and other precursor cell types using 3D printing, primarily now being applied to create tissues outside the body for drug screening and toxin screening. But there are early stage preclinical trials showing that one can print skin, for example, onto skin wounds, can print nerve grafts for spinal cord injuries in rat models. And now this work that's coming out of Pittsburgh showing that it's possible to print cartilage. Now, I think clinical applications are a ways off, because from demonstrating proof of concept in a rat model to being able to really recreate functional cartilage in a human, there's a big leap there, and the mechanics are really, really different. So how we get cartilage that's printed and sort of primitive to actually develop and mature into cartilage that can be functional in a human joint could be quite a ways off, and there's a lot of really good science to be done.
Yeah, my husband, who had meniscus surgery a few years ago, he didn't have to have a knee replacement, but does have bone on bone, so it's pretty painful for him. Well, it is if he runs, so he doesn't run.
But
he's not. It's in his lifetime, he's not going to necessarily probably have one of these 3D printed cartilage replacements.
It's difficult to say because, there are also, in addition to the scientific issues, which I think we're making quite a lot of progress on as a field, there are also regulatory issues. The idea of having a 3D printer in the clinic generating tissues that are then implanted into a patient is not an easy one to get through FDA approval. And there are reasons why. This is a new process, and it has to be demonstrated to be safe and also demonstrated to work, to form functional cartilage. In the cartilage area, there's some maybe hope on the clinical side, because there already are chondrocyte implantation protocols. So there are clinical products that take cartilage tissue from a patient, extract the chondrocytes, which are the cartilage cells, grow them for a period of time outside the body, and then implant them back into that same patient. So that process, because it's already approved for clinical use, suggests that the 3D printing side of it might become realistic sooner for cartilage than for some other tissue types.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Bill Murphy, co-director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center, and Harvey D. Spangler, professor of biomedical engineering in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We will come back with another expert. We will talk about the prevention and treatment of arthritis with a guest physician, and we will welcome your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An estimated 27 million people have arthritis, and we are talking about current research, treatment, and prevention of arthritis this hour, and welcoming your questions, experiences, and stories. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We just talked with Dr. Bill Murphy about new advancements in arthritis research when it comes to 3D printed cartilage and the promise it may hold in giving some relief to arthritis sufferers in the form of joint replacements. Now we will talk with another expert. Dr. John Wilson practices at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, where he specializes in tendonitis, arthritis, and sports-related injuries. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So, first of all, what exactly is arthritis?
Well, osteoarthritis is essentially a disease of the entire joint, and it can affect any joint in the body. It's probably a multifactorial process, meaning at the root of what we understand, as Dr. Murphy mentioned, there's a loss of that articular cartilage or that surface cartilage on the end of the bone. But there's many other processes in play, both inflammation of the joint lining, it affects the bone beneath the cartilage, and it's essentially wear and tear of that joint.
Yeah. Well, so osteoarthritis is the biggest form of arthritis, but there are other forms?
Well, osteoarthritis is by far the most common form of arthritis, but there's other types of arthritis. The one that other people have probably heard of is rheumatoid arthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis is a little bit different than osteoarthritis in that it's more of an autoimmune inflammation and destruction of the joint, where the body's immune system, which normally should be helping fight infections and stave off disease, is actually mistakenly attacking the joint and causing destruction. So osteoarthritis is more of a mechanical wear and tear destruction of the joint.
Yeah, and there's juvenile arthritis as well.
Juvenile arthritis is very similar to rheumatoid arthritis in that it's also an autoimmune condition. Not very common, but different than osteoarthritis for sure. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most children do not get osteoarthritis. It's usually considered a disease of older adulthood. But more and more, as we see our populations aging and becoming more active, we're seeing arthritis in younger and younger groups as well.
Mm-hmm. So I always pick on my poor husband because he can't stop me on these shows. But his bone-on-bone on his knee and his worn-out meniscus, is that osteoarthritis?
It is, yeah. And like your husband, I've had a meniscus surgery myself, so
mm-hmm.
I worry about what might be in store for myself. But what happens, and the meniscus cartilage is different from the articular cartilage that Dr. Murphy had talked about in the first segment of your show. The meniscus cartilage, there's actually two of them in the knee, and they're unique to the knee joint. But as the meniscus cartilage is ages, it's more prone to injury, and sometimes even traumatic injury where you can tear that cartilage, and that can cause a lot of pain and swelling in joints. And so oftentimes we'll take out the tear in what's called an arthroscopic meniscectomy. But in doing so, what we've done is we've also altered the normal joint mechanics of the knee. And through that alteration of mechanics, it does put more stress then on the articular cartilage, and oftentimes it doesn't hold up as well under that stress. So we will frequently see earlier onset osteoarthritis in someone that's had knee surgery, and not just meniscus surgery, but other surgeries as well.
Let's take a call from Al in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, who apparently also had meniscus surgery. Hi, Al.
Hello. Great conversation today. You're hitting basically in all cylinders for me. I'm about early 50s, and in my late 20s and early 30s, I had a total of two operations on each knee. Took out about 20% of the meniscus at each side, and the doctor basically told me that I have to change careers if I really want to walk after I'm 60. And I said, that's a great idea. So my question, I guess, is what is the odds that I'm, if I'm not abusing my knees anymore, what are the odds that I could end up with arthritis if I, try to take care of them and I don't have a full meniscus still left? What do you think the odds are that I will get arthritis? And I guess if you could also fill in a little bit from where they left off at the beginning of the show, what really are the odds of getting this meniscus replaced in the not terribly distant future?
Great questions, Al. Well, just looking at your age, being in your early to mid-50s, you would look at the general population and say that as we age, the risk of arthritis in the absence of any surgery starts to increase considerably. So there's a large portion of patients in their 50s and 60s who have not had any knee surgery who will start to show some signs of arthritis. And so that's just part of the aging process. Now, when you compound that with a prior meniscus surgery or two, where they removed part of that shock-absorbing, load-dispersing meniscus tissue, your risk definitely goes up. But the risk varies from person to person, so not everyone that has a meniscus surgery ends up with osteoarthritis, and there's a lot of other factors that play into it. Genetics is one. So if you have a bad family history for osteoarthritis, it may speak to the fact that you've inherited cartilage that's not as resilient. It may determine by, like you said, what you do for an occupation. Someone with a rather sedentary desk job that doesn't put a lot of stress on their knees probably has a different risk than somebody that's a manual laborer in construction or heavy lifting. So there's a lot of different factors that alter your risk. I would say that if we look at everybody that's had a meniscus surgery, we know that 10, 15, 20 years down the road, there's a high likelihood that they'll develop some degree of arthritis, whether it's mild or severe. In terms of meniscus transplants, we're already doing that type of surgery in humans, but it's not very common. It's usually reserved for very young patients in their 20s and sometimes in their 30s who have normal joint surface cartilage, that articular cartilage, and are having extreme pain after a meniscus surgery. And sometimes we can take an allograft from a cadaver and reimplant that meniscus or transplant that meniscus into their knee in hopes that we can buy them some time and prevent osteoarthritis down the road. So that's already there. We don't do it for older adults with maybe some malalignment issues in the knee or already experiencing some osteoarthritis. So it's pretty rare in older adults.
Yeah. So run-of-the-mill knee replacement surgery, Dr. Wilson, not anything to do with 3D printed cartilage. Does that, is that an ultimate cure for joint pain caused by arthritis?
It's certainly the last resort, and it is what we would consider a cure, but it's the only cure that we know of for osteoarthritis. All of our other treatments are aimed at managing symptoms to reduce pain and improve function in individuals. But when they fail, and patients have no other options and their quality of life is significantly affected by their joint pain, the knee replacement is an option. And we're talking about new advancements in arthritis treatment and research. And some of the new treatments for knee replacement are quite exciting. We're now performing what we call robotic-assisted knee replacements, where they take a 3D reconstruction of a CT scan of an individual's joint, map it out very precisely, and pick the perfect implant and put it in at the perfect position to hopefully give them the best outcome from their knee replacement. It's called makoplasty, like the shark, Mako shark. And it's allowed people to recover faster and have better outcomes from knee replacement. And not only are we replacing entire knees, now we're replacing just parts of knees. So some people don't have an entire joint that's worn out. It might just be the inner part of the knee. Mm-hmm. So we're doing unicompartmental or partial knee replacements now as well.
Wow. Let's get to another call. Steve in Madison is with us. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. On a broader level, I'm wondering whether anyone in the huge arthritis research circle is considering restrictions on sugar, corn syrup, refined white flour products as being dietary inflammatory agents that contribute to arthritis, or whether that line is considered just folk medical rumor beyond the concern of legitimate medical researchers.
Thanks, Steve. Dr. Wilson, nutrition and arthritis?
I think it's a very valid point. I'm not aware of the specific studies that are ongoing looking at the food products that Steve had mentioned, But essentially what I think he was getting at is that some of these simple sugars and simple carbohydrates are what we would consider pro-inflammatory foods, causing more of a systemic inflammation in the body. A lot of the research looking at future treatments for osteoarthritis are looking at exactly that, though, is how do we inhibit the inflammatory cascade of signals in the joint that may be causing the joint to break down. And although I'm not personally aware of diet influence and diet research that's ongoing, I bet somebody's doing it. I think it's an interesting question.
Well, we will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll be back continuing our discussion on arthritis, new research, treatment, prevention of arthritis. Osteoarthritis is what we're talking about in particular, the most common form of arthritis and the one that results in lots of disability for people in terms of joint pain. Do you suffer from arthritis? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Osteoarthritis represents 80% of all cases of arthritis, which in its various forms affects 27 million Americans, making arthritis the nation's major form of physical disability. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37. We are talking about new advancements in arthritis research and ways to prevent and treat this painful condition. And we are welcoming your questions and your experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. John Wilson. He practices at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and specializes in tendonitis, arthritis, and sports-related injuries. We have another caller waiting. Let's go to Andy in Maguanago next. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Joy. Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. I'm just curious. I'm in my 20s, and I was diagnosed with a form of arthritis called CPPD. I'm just curious what the outlook would be for that. Do I have a higher risk of developing osteoarthritis in the future? And looking online, there's very few treatments or really information about it for someone of my age. Just curious what my outlook would be and kind of what I can look forward to down the road.
Can you say I'm sorry, Andy, just for my benefit and listeners' benefit, what was the type of arthritis that you said you were diagnosed with?
It's a calcium disorder where it's kind of like gout, except it's calcium crystals in my joints, predominantly my larger joints.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, referred to as CPPD.
All right. Dr. Wilson, do you know much about this?
Yeah, I do. So CPPD, the abbreviation is calcium pyrophosphate deposition disease. And essentially, as Andy mentioned, it's where cartilage and other tissues become more calcified due to the deposition of these calcium deposits in the tissue. And we call it pseudo-gout. It oftentimes resembles the usual gout we see. Many times it's asymptomatically discovered on people when we do x-rays of their knees, and they have no idea that they have CPPD. So there's a possibility that you can live an entire life and be completely asymptomatic with it. It does tend to cause the cartilage in a joint, like the meniscus cartilage, to become a little bit stiffer. So it can decrease some of the shock-absorbing nature of the cartilage in the joint. But it doesn't necessarily mean a prognosis of bad outcome long-term for people. Usually when we see this in individuals, we also see some osteoarthritis, the usual arthritis, and this is just an incidental finding on their x-ray. So that may have been what, in Andy's case, we treated essentially the same as osteoarthritis. And if it's asymptomatic, we don't have to do anything with it. If there's an acute flare of CPPD, we can treat it with anti-inflammatories and steroid injections, similar to how we treat gout.
Okay, Andy?
thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call. Well, so Andy's in his 20s. Is there something we should be doing when we're younger to prevent arthritis when we're older?
Well, we can't change the time clock, so we're all going to get older.
Mm-hmm.
We can't change our genes, at least not yet. So the genes that we've gotten from our parents are the genes that we're stuck with for now. So the things that we can modify and influence, the ones that are probably most important are body weight. One of the biggest risk factors for osteoarthritis in big joints like knees and hips and even smaller joints like the hands tends to be obesity. And part of that may be the inflammatory milieu in the body that the earlier caller alluded to. And some of it's just simply the stress that the joint sees. So if people want to limit their stress on their joints, whether they're in their 20s or if they already have osteoarthritis in their 50s, the biggest thing they can do is really watch their weight. And other things that are helpful are keeping the muscles around joints strong. So as we age, it's very common to become less active, and with that, muscles weaken, and that thereby puts more stress on the joint. I always tell people that when their x-rays are showing signs of osteoarthritis, it's as if their internal joint shock absorbers are worn out, but they can still build up the external shock absorbers in their muscles. So losing weight or maintaining a healthy body weight and keeping strong and active are probably the most important things people can do.
Yeah, well, what about... I know I have friends who were into sports quite a bit through high school and college, and kind of high impact stuff. And they're kind of limping around right now. And lazy old me, I don't have any signs of that. So should we be limiting high impact sports activities?
Well, I certainly don't want your listeners to get the idea that being lazy and sedentary is a good idea.
I'm just teasing.
Yeah, no, I know, but. In terms of sports, there have been a lot of large population studies that have looked at the risk of arthritis in people who have played sports in their younger years. And the biggest factor that seems to be related to whether or not you'll develop arthritis later in life is whether or not you sustained an injury to a joint playing those sports. So if you play sports that are high impact and you don't have any injuries, you're probably okay. If you start to develop injuries like a meniscus tear or an ACL ligament tear in your knee, well, then all of a sudden your risk goes up. And so it's more of the risk of injury during those sports than the sports themselves for developing osteoarthritis.
Yeah. Well, what about now? We're in our aging baby boomers. How should we be exercising now? I noticed, for instance, the jumping around aerobic things that I have tried, like Zumba, make my joints ache. But the lower impact stuff feels just fine.
Well, if people like Zumba and they tolerate those higher impact activities, I don't think that there's a problem with it. But if you're getting some feedback of joint stiffness, joint pain, that's probably your joint's way of telling you that amount of impact is probably a little bit too much. When I see people in clinic with osteoarthritis of their knees or hips, for example, and they want to be runners, if they tolerate running or even marathons, I'll let them run marathons. But we know that amount of impact is probably going to cause more pain and stiffness. So I usually recommend that they adopt, more low-impact exercises. Walking is a great one. There's the elliptical machines at the gym. Exercise, biking, and swimming are great low-impact exercises, and you can still reap the benefits of bone health and also get the cardiovascular benefits from those forms of exercise.
We are talking with Dr. John Wilson, who specializes in tendonitis, arthritis, and sports-related injuries. He practices at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health about arthritis, and we are welcoming your questions about arthritis. Do you suffer from arthritis, osteoarthritis in particular, or maybe another form? That's okay, too. How do you cope? How have you been dealing with it? What treatments have worked for you? Share your story with us, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about arthritis, and how to prevent, how to treat it, how to cope with it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Also talking about new advancements in arthritis research. Our guest is Dr. John Wilson, who is with the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And our next caller is Wayne in Hartford. Hello, Wayne.
Good morning. Good morning, George. Good morning, doctor. I just wanted to toss in a comment about athletics and getting injured a long, long time ago. I totally shattered an ankle jogging, staying in shape, and went. Everything went great for about 35 years, and then the arthritis set in, and it eventually led to a total ankle replacement. Now, luckily today, my ankle's great. The rest of my body's in fantastic shape. I'm still strong and athletic, but it was amazing that for a while, that ankle, I couldn't, it got to the point where I was walking on crutches. The arthritis was so bad.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's a very debilitating disease, especially when it affects such an important weight-bearing joint like the ankle or the knee. And when it starts to get in the way of physical activity, there are good treatments. And although we don't do a lot of ankle replacements, we do sometimes when it gets severe like Wayne's injury. Wayne brings up a good point about the post-traumatic osteoarthritis and the delay between when the injury occurs and when we see the symptoms develop, and that's pretty typical. A lot of times we'll hear about these old injuries in high school or even younger, in 20, 30 years down the road, then we see the consequences of osteoarthritis in a joint. And fortunately, when all of our conservative, non-invasive treatments fail, there's always an option of joint replacement for most joints, and including shoulders, fingers, hips, and knees.
Yeah. Before the replacement, though, and after we take off a few pounds and exercise in the way we that doesn't hurt us, what else can be done to alleviate the pain of arthritis?
I think that most practitioners would usually recommend a very progressive, stepwise, but aggressive approach to managing pain. And I say aggressive because I think it is important to alleviate pain and improve function, so that people don't become sedentary, gain weight, and develop other health problems as a result of that. So we usually start with real simple things. I think probably the evidence would support the most effective thing we can do is physical therapy. And physical therapy exercises with a physical therapist directing the program. It's helpful at restoring normal range of motion to the joint because typically these joints become stiff, and especially improving the strength around that joint. We all know about anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen or naproxen, Aleve. Those anti-inflammatories are usually helpful at helping with pain from the inflammation of the joint. We often use braces to both keep the joint warm but also provide some stability to the joint, since many people feel like the joint isn't quite as stable as it once was and they lack confidence in the joint. We'll sometimes use injectable medications for joints, such as corticosteroids, to relieve inflammation and pain. And now we'll oftentimes also do a synthetic joint fluid injection to help lubricate and cushion the joint. So all of those things, going from the very simple conservative things all the way to the more aggressive injections, are an option. There is some supplements available as well. Glucosamine and chondroitin are very common joint supplements that are available over the counter. The evidence is mixed whether or not they help a lot, but some people certainly tend to respond to them, and they're generally pretty safe. So if that's something that people want to try, they're welcome to. And there's a new supplement called ASU, or avocado soy unsaponifiables. It's a mouthful, but ASU, the abbreviation, is a little bit easier to say. And there's some evidence now that's saying that that might help with pain and inflammation and arthritis.
Never heard of it. Interesting. What about tart cherry juice? Have you heard that one?
I have, mm-hmm. Yep. And again, not a lot of studies out there for cherry juice, but probably a mild anti-inflammatory like some of the other over-the-counter treatments available.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Let's take another call from Eric in Nisida. Hello, Eric.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's your issue today?
Well, I'm a weightlifting coach and a powerlifting coach, and I had a torn labrum in my hip, and I kind of let myself go, but found that if I, you know, hit the weights really hard over the last year, my hip function has improved quite a bit. And I want to know what you think of, the weightlifting portion reducing osteoarthritis.
Well, the labrum, just for the listeners, the labrum is a very tiny lip of cartilage that surrounds the cup portion of the hip joint. It's somewhat similar to a meniscus cartilage in a knee joint, but somewhat different. And we sometimes see those labrum tears in people that do hip flexion type activities. And we also see them as part of the wear and tear degenerative process of osteoarthritis. So sometimes it's hard to know whether or not the labrum is an acute tear or whether or not it's part of the degeneration of the entire joint. But what I think Eric touched on, it's an important point that I mentioned earlier, is strengthening the muscles around a joint are oftentimes very helpful for alleviating symptoms, whether it's a labral tear or osteoarthritis in a joint. So, the fact that he improved with strengthening those muscles is excellent, and what we often try to accomplish with physical therapy. In patients with osteoarthritis in a hip or a knee, sometimes a heavy weightlifting activity like a squat is just too much stress on that joint to withstand, and so some people don't always tolerate it. But a physical therapist who's trained in treating osteoarthritis can help patients determine what activities are a good idea and which ones are probably ones to avoid.
Thanks, Eric, for the call. Since you brought up hip, we haven't really talked about hip replacements. I know people who are, to me, pretty young. I mean, they're my age, and they're having hip replacements. That's due to the osteoarthritis, too?
It is. Anytime we replace joints, that we're replacing them usually because the joint is worn to a point where it's affecting quality of life, including pain and stiffness. And so hip replacements, also like knee replacements, are done for arthritis. We really don't like to replace joints in young individuals for a good reason. The artificial components that we put in to take the place of the damaged joint have a finite lifespan. They don't have the ability to regenerate and recuperate like normal tissue. So when we put that artificial component in there, there's always a chance that through normal wear that it could wear out. And it's hard to predict how long it's going to last in an individual. And the last thing we would want to do is replace a joint and then have to come back 15, 20 years or longer later and have to redo that whole operation again, because chances are it's going to be a much more involved procedure. So we try to wait as long as possible, but sometimes pain and disability necessitate joint replacements at younger ages.
Our next caller is Gary in Illinois. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to, I'm an ex-runner. I've run for 40 years. I'm currently 60. And I've been diagnosed with osteoarthritis. And, you know, I currently kind of live with the discomfort. It's bone on bone. And I got bone spurs on my hip. So I'm considering a total hip replacement. And just wanted to know if there's any alternatives to that. What is your opinion of a total hip replacement at my age?
Great questions, Gary. I think if your osteoarthritis is not terribly severe, some of the things that you might try if you haven't already are physical therapy, as we mentioned, some lower impact exercises. So if you can't tolerate running anymore, you may opt for a cycling career or swimming to get that same exercise fix that you get from running. When anti-inflammatories by mouth aren't effective for relieving pain, then sometimes we'll try a cortisone injection for pain relief in the hip. But when none of those things are giving you the relief that you're looking for at your age, I think a total hip arthroplasty or hip replacement is a viable option. Sometimes it's better to do it at an age when you're still active and can reap the benefits of that increased activity once your hip feels better than waiting another 15 or 20 years when you're not as active.
Gary, thanks very much for the call. We move now to Sally in Madison. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Last year I was told that I have trochanteric bursitis, which is this pain that often appears in my hip in the morning. And if I'm walking, all of a sudden it'll come along And then if I sit down for a minute or so, it goes away. And I wanted to know how it came about, if you could help with that.
Is bursitis related to arthritis, Dr. Wilson?
We see it a lot in osteoarthritis patients. And you know, to get to Sally's question about what caused the bursitis, trochanteric bursitis is an inflammation of a fluid-filled sac on the outside of the hip, outside of the joint. But oftentimes with people with osteoarthritis, their muscles weaken over time. And as those muscles in the hip and pelvic region weaken, sometimes it can put excess stress on the tissues on the outside part of the hip, and then you can develop this irritant bursitis in the side of the hip. It's a tough condition for many people, which is very debilitating, but I would say that most oftentimes it's related to some weakness in and around the hip. So physical therapy is probably a very good place to start in treating that.
Maybe we have time for one more call. Jane in Madison. Hi, Jane.
Hi, good morning. Say, I just wanted to make a comment about hip replacements. I had my first hip replaced at 40, and my second replaced at age 46. Wow. I had congenital hip dysplasia, which is shallow hip sockets. And really my advice to folks is to not wait. I hear a lot of surgeons saying, wait as long as you can. And I know that it's my fate that I'll have both of those replaced again in my lifetime. But getting those hips replaced was really life-changing, and I'm active, and I'm healthy, and I have no pain. And before that, I was walking with a cane, and I didn't know if I'd be able to walk to the end of the block and back, you know, to walk my kids to the bus stop. And it's really changed my life, and I'd like to encourage people to not be afraid, particularly with hips, and to get them replaced if you're in pain.
Thanks for your encouragement, Jean. I think you were certainly a unique story with your congenital hip dysplasia and a great success story that you're doing so well now. And, you know, I agree with you. I think some people do wait too long, and you hear back from them after they've suffered for years and they finally had a knee or a hip replacement, and they all say, I wish I hadn't waited so long. But it's a serious operation, and it should be taken seriously and given lots of consideration regarding the risks, because there's not always a guarantee with surgeries like that. And so I think it's a discussion to be had with an orthopedic surgeon very seriously.
Well, a lot of interest in this topic. Obviously, a lot of people affected by it. Any 30 seconds for maybe where we can go for more information about arthritis?
Well, the Arthritis Association, arthritis.org, is a great place for information for patients, and you can also come to the UW Health Orthopedics website for more information as well. Thanks for having me, Joy. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for being with us. Dr. John Wilson with the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Thanks to Robin Cherry and to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.